We come to the second presentation of our 2012 major series, Hermetic Bodhisattvas, which is combing through the origins and the way in which a complex wisdom threshold came in as a carrier wave 2,000 years ago. And that carrier wave hearkened back in two steps. One step was 1,000 years before that, a millennium, and the second step was 1,000 more years, so that the pair of the millennia became an aeon, or a new age. And that quality of an age is stressed each time that either a millennium or an aeon occurs. It's interesting because the referential carrier wave of 2000 BC was a pair of figures that are now poised in our time in a regressive, antithetical, almost nuclear war possibility. The one figure of that 2000 BC carrier wave was Abraham. And so one finds in the 0 BC carrier wave constant reference, not only back to Abraham, but to the millennial double figure of 1000 BC, which was the end of King David's life and reign, and the beginning of his son Solomon taking over from him and completing the temple. So that one has this in a very simple way. The New Testament begins with a simple three-part statement. These are the generations of Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. So that you get in the Gospel of Matthew, right at the beginning of the New Testament, you get a compression. And that compression is of a triple language phrase packed together like the balance of a three-legged stool, or classically, the balance of a three-legged tripod. And the tripod was always the ancient way of making sure that the sacrifice was sacred. And the sacrifice was to purify the space and to give a purification of time so that one entered into the sense of timelessness and the sense of vast space, and that this then was the sacred space in the sacred timelessness or eternity. The three legs of the tripod in 0 BC, one leg was Philo of Alexandria, the second leg was Mary Magdalene, and the third leg was Joseph, the father of Jesus. And those three figures give us the basic symbol of the beginning. And Philo, as we have seen, was able to engender a community, followers of the way, the new way in Alexandria. And he passed the mantle of that growing community onto Apollos. Apollos as the author of Epistle to the Hebrews in the New Testament. Just so, Mary Magdalene was able to pass on her mentoring to young Saint John, who was about 12 years old at the time of the crucifixion resurrection, and a Jewish young man at that age is prepared by a year of counsel and study and reading for his bar mitzvah. And that the mitzvah is the witnessing before the community, as the community then is witnessing before God. And so there is again a tripartite quality to sacredness, to purification, to holiness. When Mary Magdalene's mentor grew up, he became Saint John. And when Philo's mentoring person grew up as Apollos of Alexandria, the two of them met in 57 AD for the comesis, the going to sleep of Mary Magdalene. Apollos traveled from Alexandria to go to Ephesus and be there. His traveling mate was Zenon, a very famous lawyer, also a follower of the way. They didn't call it Christianity. Christianity is an appellation that came out of a community in Antioch some time later. The way in which St. John accompanied Apollos back to Alexandria from 57 to 68 AD was a time of the community expanding such that there was an enormous energy. And Alexandria, in that time period, became a magnet for power in the world from the ground up and from the heaven down. And it was in Alexandria at that time that Vespasian became the new Roman emperor, not just the new Roman emperor, but the Caesar family was eclipsed by the Flavian family. And it's interesting to see that he was acclaimed in Alexandria and that the seal of his achievement, his being raised to a new dynasty of Roman emperors, was that he had two miracles. He was able to take some spittle and mix it with some Egyptian dust and coat the eyes of a blind man, and he was able to see. We recognize that as one of the miracles of Jesus. He also was able to lay hands on a lame man, and that man was able to walk again. These are the kind of earmarks that crunch together the Roman imperial power and the high magnetic spiritual tone of Jesus' way. And what we're looking at is not a religious outlook. We're looking in terms of extra dimensions. We're looking in terms of a fifth dimension to space-time, which is vision, so that it is quintessential. And that quintessentialness is that it, like the thumb with the four fingers, it's opposable. That means that these fingers together are like the four dimensions of an integral cycle and order, and this quintessential dimension is differential. So that consciousness in a differential field is able then to make a new kind of hand. And that hand is paired. And the raising of the two hands in the orant's position is the most ancient way of praying to the divine. The 0 BC modification of it was that the hands were made open. Not so much in the expected integral that this is the cross, the crucifixion, but that this is the welcoming of all. And that is a complete new radical change. And one can see in the Hermetica that came out of the community in Alexandria in the 90s AD. The very beginning of the Hermetica, the Poimandres, the mind shepherd, the shepherd of not the brain, not the structure of thought, but the resonances that constitutes mind in differential conscious visioning, the ability to not only envision, but to see double in an allegorical sense, not just in a metaphorical sense, which would be mythic, but an allegorical sense, which is being able to see double. And one of the classic Hermetic developments, much later on, an instrument handcrafted by Benjamin Franklin, was the bifocal glasses, so that if you looked down, you could see close to read, and if you looked up, you could see far to be able to discern. The allegorical visioning is like this kind of Benjamin Franklin glasses. But if you add a third quality to it, it becomes a trifocal. And that trifocal capacity is what came out in the 90s AD in Alexandria by the community that had been shepherded by Apollos and St. John in view of their mentors, Philo and Mary Magdalene, and brought together in such a way that the third leg of that tripod was now transformed, not just Joseph as the father of Jesus, but of a great Holy Spirit that now was the presencing of God indeed. And the transformation of that was set up in such a way that an ancient series of writings called collectively, the Book of Enoch, was composed about 200 BC, beginning then, and was a series of four books that were brought together. One, a great vision of fallen angels, of beings from outer space coming and seducing the daughters of men, and that the children that they had were called giants, not that they were physically so tall or big, but that they were had capacities that ordinary men did not have. One of Philo's great books is called The Giants. The books of Enoch were collected together, and one finds the four books in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the Book of Enoch contains five books, and the second book, the Book of the Parables, is not in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in fact, it was not until about 200 years ago that it was even suspected that the Book of Enoch had five books, including the Book of Parables. And that Book of Parables was discovered in Ethiopia by a Scotsman named James Bruce. And he purchased it and brought it back to London. And when one reads in the Book of Parables, one gets a new quality of dimension that has come into play, not just vision, but history. That there is a historical dimension as well, and that the historical dimension raises the differential consciousness of vision into what I have called a kaleidoscopic consciousness. That is to say, one of the translations from the way in which the Mahayana, as we will see, became the Vajrayana. In the Vajrayana, not only is there a cosmos with bodhisattvas, but there is a jewel matrix out of which cosmoses without end are able to be engendered. It is that Vajra, that jewel, that diamond quality, which history develops because something in between vision and history, called the spiritual person, is able to be refined without end. And in being refined, its simile was always that it was like a jewel cutter who took the raw jewel and by knowing how to cut the facets, turned it into the real jewel. The way in which we will find in the Mahayana about 800 AD, the sutra is called the Vajracchedika Sutra, the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And that Diamond Cutter Sutra takes its cue from the phrase first used by Philo of Alexandria about 20 AD, that the cutter of the person's spiritual capacities into its jewel-like facets is the word, the logos cutter. And Philo constantly says, we now have a logos cutter whose language, whose word is able to come into the amphitheater of the visionary mind and engender a prismatic spirit person who is able to be given extra facets as the historical dimension comes into play. And if you count vision as a fifth dimension, the prismatic person, the art of the spiritual person making, would be a sixth dimension. And the seventh dimension would be that historical kaleidoscopic refining and refining, leading to an eighth dimension where one, for the first time, has a real analytic. Just as in art, one can have a real aesthetic for the first time, not only to make good crafts, but to make works of art that are improved by critique and by honing experience and bringing one's vision into a double play, creative imagining and remembering. And the remembering is able to reach back into the structure of the mind so that the memory as a form is able to take the transformational amplitude of remembering. And because remembering is without end, it's out of an infinite field. The memory of man now is able to transform the structure of memory in the mind constantly, constantly, constantly. And the same with creative imagining is able to reach back to the imagination, to the way in which images and feelings are related together. And by putting them into the pliable play of remembering and creative imagining, the art of spirit person prismatic making proceeds apace. That art is harmonious with the analytic that establishes the cosmos, not a universe, but all possible worlds. It is a beautiful quality to see that this eight-part, eight-dimension quality, like the four fingers coming together, make a kind of a prayer. And if the fifth quintessential visionary dimension has been operative, then a ninth will come into play. And in the Hermetica, there's constantly the reminder that we are told that when one completes the Ogdoad, the eight phase, one is able to hear through a ninth, a singing in the tenth, that there is something like a celestial choir constantly in praise of the presence of God. And one could not hear that until one entered into the ninth. And so one of the great Hermetic treatises that was conveniently lost in the time of Constantine in the early 300s AD was found again with the Nag Hammadi material in Egypt in 1945. The eighth reveals the ninth, but the ninth also further reveals a tenth dimension. Now those 10 dimensions are like the quintessential vision, now has become the complementarity of the two, four dimensional, four differential, four integral. And so the complementarity raises the energy, and the tenth now becomes like the pair to it. And so the singing in a super celestial way, that's how they used to talk and write in about 500 AD, Dionysius the Areopagite used the term super celestial. Later on in the Renaissance, 1,000 years later, the great commentator on Dionysius the Areopagite's writings was Dean John Colet of St. Paul's in London. He learned to vision from Ficino in Florence, but he was brilliant in himself and in his two great companions, Sir Thomas More and Erasmus of Rotterdam, who did a lot of teaching and writing in England, taught at Cambridge University, was the first person since antiquity to be able to read New Testament Greek well enough to put out a new edition of it in Greek and to translate it perfectly into Latin. This was 1516. So that all of the European languages could translate out of Latin into the popular language of people. Colet wrote a four-volume commentary on Dionysius the Areopagite, which is, of course, translated into English. I'll bring a set of it when we get further into understanding how these things work. The 10 dimensions have an echo, is the best way to talk about it. The echo would be an 11th dimension, but it does not appear countable. It's like string theory having 11 dimensions. But when one moves from a 10-dimensional hyperspace, one moves into the zero field of nature. And what changes is that the zero field becomes fertile. It is a zero field, but it's a fertile zero field. How is it fertile? It is fertile because it has an infinite field that, to use an alchemical term, anneals with it. And so one is not only zero, but one is perfectly fertile zero. The two transformations, one is a fermentation to make the wine out of the completeness. The second is to make the distillation, which is a perfection. Just to be complete seems satisfactory enough when you're in space-time, when you're just talking about a universe. But perfection is all possible worlds. worlds without end. It's a quality in the beginning of the Hermetica, in the Poimandres, in the Mind Shepherd, that there is a turning. It, in Greek, is a metanoia. It is a turning of the way in which creation in Genesis was talked about. In Genesis, as it begins, this is the Revised Standard edition of it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. In the Hermetica, there is a radical difference. In the Hermetica, light was eternal. And only in the eternalness, the eternity of light, came the Greek translates as a darkness form that had crooked dimensions, crooked boundaries, which means that it was like smoke. And that dark smoke did not recognize, had no way to recognize that it was occurring phenomenally in a super celestial light of which it had no inkling whatsoever. And one finds the turning point between the Genesis of Moses and the Poimandres of the Hermetica is the Gospel of St. John, written about 68 AD in Alexandria, right at the pinnacle of not only the Caesars being replaced permanently, not only the siege of Jerusalem and eventually the temple well underway and not able to be curtailed any further, and St. John going back to Ephesus, where he established six other churches, so that there were seven churches in that Roman province of Asia Minor, what is today Turkey. Later on, when he was seized by the jealous second son of Vespasian, a brat of a man named Domitian, his older brother Titus was a rather stalwart, elegant man who became Roman emperor after his father passed on, but only survived for 2 years. And then the brat, Domitian, came into play and became fiercely jealous of the way in which there was a power, magnetic quality emanating from Ephesus, from St. John. And so he had St. John arrested and brought to Rome and was trying to put him to death by dropping him into a vat of boiling oil and was unable to do it. And so in anger of being stymied, he built a huge temple to himself in Ephesus with a statue almost 30 feet high of himself, the arm of which was holding up a fist, is taller than a man. I will bring a photograph of that from the archaeological dig that found it, and sentenced St. John to the island of Patmos, which was just a rock shaped like a ship that will never go anywhere. And it's there that he wrote the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation. The Book of Revelation is written right at the end of Domitian's life and term. He died in 96 AD, and in 97, it was again like the time of Vespasian. In 68 AD, there were four different emperors in 1 year. No one could occupy the seat, the throne. Again, no one could occupy the throne in 97. An old man named Nerva was brought in as Roman emperor, and he couldn't last. And so Trajan came in and made a decision. Trajan was a great general in the Dacian Wars. His decision was not to go into Rome and assume physically the power, but to send his power in the old Roman custom of building a huge forum, the Forum of Trajan. And it was about 6 or 7 years ago that the Getty Museum finished all of the archaeology of the Foro Trajano and published a 3-volume huge set. I'll bring in a copy of that as well, showing the immense power and sophistication of Trajan's forum in Rome, which was the projection of his power into Rome, but not exposing his person. And when it came time for Trajan to pass on the Roman Empire, he passed it on to Hadrian and said, "Do not spend time in Rome." We would say today it's radioactive. It is visionarily radioactive. Almost no one is going to be able to stay there. It's interesting because while Abraham is one of the 2000 BC carrier waves, the other one is Zarathustra. So that you have the beginnings of Israel and the beginnings of Iran as twin-tuned carrier waves 4,000 years ago. How does it happen that there is this regression? It happens this way, that time forms that are not fulfilled, that are not completed, so that then they can be perfected, tend not only to backslide, but to create avalanches of regression. But the millennia count as well. And if we look at the fact that we have discussed that time forms occur in an overlapping pair, each of the pair have their carrier wave moments, each have their reference wave moments. The reference wave is usually about 350 years before a carrier wave, and then 1,000 years later is 650 years after the carrier wave. And then another millennium after that is a second reference wave. The second reference wave is always a renaissance. The first carrier wave is always a lurking negativity that, if not responded to comprehensively, it shoots, slingshots us back into the regression of the carrier wave twice removed, now turned it into a negativity. The carrier wave of 650 AD is Muhammad and Tang Tai Tsung, the founder of the most powerful Chinese dynasty. So that you have a reference wave in our old aeon of Islam and China, which were changed, transformed 350 years ago in 1650 AD by Isaac Newton and by Leibniz. That Newton was able to mathematize language in such a way that our optical capacity for an analytic was able to be elegantly expressed in a very high prismatic mathematics called calculus. So that, in a way, Newton refined the way in which from Abraham to Jesus, as carrier waves, refined it so that there was a focus, and the last 30 years of his life, he tried everything he could to clarify the focus. For him, there were two books that were intuitively, visionarily related together. One was the book of Daniel, the other was the Apocalypse of St. John. That somehow they were the parentheses of the most powerful statement about time and man that had been delivered. When one looks at the book of Daniel, right in the middle of the 12 books of Daniel is the transition from book 6 to book 7. And it's in book 7 of Daniel that one finds one of the most powerful statements about the Son of Man who will come in a future age threshold that will come 490 years later, 70 times 7. So that the sevens and the powers of 10 work together in this, and one gets then, the closer one got to the 490 years predicted by Daniel 7 with the coming of the Son of Man, that the time recognition shifted to jubilees. That instead of looking at time as Roman time or as Greek time, one began to have a community of people, the Essenes especially, being able to recalibrate so that they could tell what time it was, the time of the arrival. It's interesting to see that those jubilees are so powerful that you find it in the graphically and yet hidden structure of the Gospels. The first Gospel of Matthew has 28 chapters, four sevens. And if you read Matthew seven chapters at a stretch all the way through, you get 4 times 7, 28. And if you read St. John, you get 3 times 7, 21. Those make a 49. That's the Jubilee. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back to Mary Magdalene. Let's come back to Mary Magdalene. We read in the Gospel of Matthew that the father, Joseph, was a dream master. But like the biblical Daniel, he was able to twice over deepen his capacity for dream analysis. To analyze dreams is to focus upon the mythic horizon, the images and feelings in dreams are in that mythic phase. To be able to get into deeper dreams, dreams that are immensely important, one has to move into vision. Somebody who is good psychologically at dreams will not have any contact with vision unless there is a deep transform. But there is a third quality. Just as vision transforms and deepens myth, history perfects and further transforms vision, in which case one is able to see the future. But not just the future, because time would just be future if one were be one would be stuck in a symbolic computation that there is just this present moment and things before it are in the past and what's coming is in the future. The present moment is an existential symbolic conception and in fact does not exist. What does occur deeper than existence is presence. So one does not stand presently before God, but one stands within the presence of God. The ancient phrase was the angel of the presence. When presence comes into play in the field of vision, the historical dimension, that seventh dimension of the historical kaleidoscopic consciousness, begins to understand the symmetry. That the not the continuum as a kind of an abstraction, but that the energy frequency of time spontaneously occurring out of the eternal, carrying with it the three dimensions of space, which instantaneously blossom out of time, but time spontaneously occurs out of eternity. So that in order to come to the energy continuum of time forms, one has to be able to see forward and backward in terms of a continuum, in terms of a presencing that has, as we talked about last week, the breath of the eternal. When at 12, Jesus, again in Matthew, was found teaching in the temple instead of being taught for his, he was 12, he's going to have a bar mitzvah in one more year. The father, Joseph, who was not only a dream master and not only a deep dream master, but also a visionary, understood that he needed a large preparation for what would be his bar mitzvah. And so he made arrangements to have him sent back to Alexandria. And as a gift to him, he wrote the book of parables, which is the fifth book, the differential conscious book in the book of Enoch. And in order for that to be understood, several recent books have come out. Their study of the book of Enoch, the first four books, was done by Professor Nicholsberg, and it came out decades ago, and it took George Nicholsberg and his good friend James Vanderkam almost a generation to do an equal-sized book, 700-some pages, on just the Book of Parables of Enoch. And it just came out within this last year. The second is that there have been several hundred professors from around the world who have gathered together in Italy every couple of years to do Enoch seminars. And 2 seminars ago, Enoch and the Messiah, Son of Man, because the parables are all about a figure who is emerging in presence, not in the future, but presencing now and emerging more and more. And that this Son of Man, a messianic figure, needed to have a conference. And the third is that this book was published just a few years ago in Scotland, The Son of Man in the Parables of Enoch and in Matthew. And one finds that consistently what Matthew was being able to bring out in his gospel is in the three seeds of the three parables of the book of the parables of Enoch. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls were buried in their jars, in their caves in 31 BC. There was a tremendous earthquake that struck the Qumran community so severely and exactly that it split into the baptismal pond and the stairs leading down into that pond. And so they saw that there was an apocalyptic end to their community, that something had happened. In 31 BC, Octavian became Augustus Caesar and ruled the world for 44 years after that by defeating Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Also in 31 BC, Joseph, the father of Jesus, was born so that he would be, when Jesus was born, in 9 BC, he would have a chance at 22, 23 years of age to be able to deeply vision what had happened and what was going on. And the confirmation came to him from the three magi who were able, because of the ancient stargazing capacity, to vision patterns of stars and celestial movements. And those three magi were Iranians. When Marco Polo was on his way back from China, he visited those three cities in Iran that still commemorate that the Magi were there. So we're faced with a peculiarity. The Holy Family was able to go into Egypt by Iranian financing to save their lives and their future, which makes the present tragic moment acute, because it is a problem of time form not being understood. It is the rage of ignorance on all sides. All of this is to be of critiquing and of analytical, critical guidance and help to understand there is no built-in nightmare present. And the transformation to presencing in vision and to kaleidoscopic opening in the dimension of history will provide the evaporation of the nightmare. It is not something to overcome. It is something to wake up from. There is no problem. One of the beautiful things in the Gospel of John, right at the beginning, reads this way. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. One of the ways in which, when I republished my notes on the ancient Hermetic writings from 1990 to in 2009, with a couple of pages, and one of the short little couple of sentences read this way. In the Hermetica, in a discourse of mine to Hermes, number 11 out of 14, we read, "Power outside God makes God God, and is the madness of the impossible which men dream up in their unmysterious grasping. Jesus is the way." The church, we're stewards to help prepare and remind not to assume God's power for men, which is true of not only Judaism and Christianity, but of Islam, of all religions. They are reminders and helpers, not rulers. All that can be evaporated. When Joseph was preparing the 12-year-old Jesus to go back to Alexandria and gifted him with the Son of Man parables to take with him as a part of his contribution towards his preparation for his mitzvah. Not just a bar mitzvah, but a divine mitzvah, a witnessing. He was taken back by ship because the Jewish trading routes were ancient. They had taken over, in fact, a number of the ancient shipping routes that were established by the original Phoenicians. And that in the time of Abraham already, it was several hundreds of years old because the Semitic king of kings, Sargon of Akkad, in 2350 BC, already had established shipping from Ugarit, Ras Shamra, the point of fennel, out to Cyprus and further out all the way into the Greek islands, Crete and so forth, 4,400 years ago. When the Phoenicians developed their trade routes, they pushed all the way across the Mediterranean Sea, out through the Straits of Gibraltar, into the Atlantic Ocean. They needed a huge trading port to handle the immense value of the trading, and that's why in 800 BC they established Carthage. They needed another big trading port because they found that there was a shortcut going north. You didn't have to go out of the Straits of Gibraltar and up the coast of what is today Portugal and Spain, but one could, at the place that they established in 600 BC, 200 years after Carthage, they established what became Marseille, because one can go up the Rhone River without the Atlantic storms. And if you go far enough up the Rhone, there's a tributary that goes to the west, and that tributary comes very near to another tributary that is coming from another huge river, the Loire. And if you make a simple portage around a hill between those two little streams, one can go from Marseille to the west country of England, to Ireland, to all those points, with only having to cross the wide mouth of the English Channel on open sea. That peak is called Pilate's Peak, as in Pilate of the crucifixion of Jesus, and was named by the Holy Family because that's the way they went to Glastonbury, up the Rhone, portaging over, up the Loire. And one finds that along the way, when they got far enough on the Loire, news came to them. They had to move slowly. It took a long time for them to go. News came to them that there was a huge visionary understanding that there was going to be, as in the continuity of time forms, there was going to be a sleeper, a Sleeping Beauty. And so the castle of Sleeping Beauty is located on the Loire and I will bring in a photograph of it next week. And it is a tribute to the future vision of Mary Magdalene being laid to rest in her Comesis in the cave of the seven sleepers, so that the fairy tale, not a myth, a fairy tale is conscious. A fairy tale always has a turn. It has a twist near the end that recalibrates the entire meaning of what you're being not told so much, but what you're being able to envision. Because you have to envision fairy tales. The great commentary in our time is by J.R.R. Tolkien in his little book, long essay on fairy tales. And you can get copies of it and read it for yourself. The Lord of the Rings is a very large fairy tale. Here's how Jesus came to Tyre, because the Phoenicians worked out of Tyre. They built the ships in Sidon because it had proximity to the cedars of Lebanon. But the shipping went out of Tyre, and ancient Tyre was the original home of Pythagoras' father, Menesarchus, about 600 BC, about the time that they were establishing Marseille. And one of the last great philosophers of antiquity, Porphyry of Tyre, who died in 305, was the one who put Plotinus' Aeneids together and was himself a tremendous philosopher. So Tyre was always civilized for more than 1,200 years. And when Mary Magdalene's father came down, her father's name was Simon, he came down with leprosy. And so the family had to move from Magdala on the Sea of Galilee, which had proximity to the coastal family trading route located in Tyre. They had to move to where the father could be put into a leper colony, which was on the far side of the Mount of Olives, and the little village is called Bethany. And so they built a villa, quite substantial. They were quite wealthy people. And in Bethany, they were able to walk to the leper ravine colony and send food down, to send clothing down by rope, by bucket. And if you want to see a film presentation of that, you can rent Ben-Hur, and you'll find in William Wyler's Ben-Hur a recreation of that leper ravine that's there within walking distance of Bethany. Because it was also a leper colony, it as well had burial chambers. And this is a photograph of the tomb of Lazarus. Now you can see that it's ill-tended. And you will find in the presentations here almost everything that is of value on the way has been sidestepped by the church. Several decades ago, the tomb of St. John was so desecrated with filth that an American group from Ohio had to put bars over it to keep it from being desecrated further. So Lazarus and John, as important as they are, and they, in a way, give us the Mary Magdalene. Her older brother took over protecting her, took her to Tyre, made sure that she got one of the best educations of the time. She was taught continuously so that she was proficient in Greek as well as Hebrew, in Syriac as well as Aramaic, in Latin. She was colossal. her beautiful quality comes out in her Odes of Solomon. There are 42 of them, and they were written between the time when she decided she was not going to marry. In those days, women married 16, 17 at the most. She had seen the 12-year-old Jesus and her brother Lazarus taking him to Alexandria, and some 4 or 5 years later, when it came time to prepare for her, she said, "I am not going to be married, but I want to go and study and hear the by now maturing Jesus." And this is from the first Ode of Solomon, just a few lines to let you hear how she begins. "The Lord is on my head like a wreath, and I shall never be without him. Plaited for me is the wreath of truth, and it caused thy branches to blossom in me. For it is not like a parched crown that blossoms not, but thou livest upon my head and have blossomed upon me. Thy fruits are full and complete. They are full of thy wisdom." Later on, the night before the Last Supper, we read in the Gospel of Matthew that in the house of Simon the leper, while Jesus was gathered, giving the last parable teaching, it's in the Gospel of Matthew at the end of book chapter 25, verses 31 to 46, and then you can read the outcome in chapter 26. It's beautiful. And of course, he, to emphasize, always would have the refrain, "Those who have ears to hear, let them hear." That is that it isn't just the sound, the noise that comes into the ear, but that the ear tunes the sound to language. And the tuning of sound to language brings it out of chaos, combs it into communication. The ancient way of understanding it was that before there was a visible universe, there was a confused sound, that the deep is a sounding deep, and that hearing precedes seeing. This is why the akousmatiki were the initiates and the mathematiki were those after 5 years, by that time, used to being able to hear directly without a scrambling. In the world that we live in now, there is a difficulty for people to see a photograph like this and understand the tremendous significance of it. This is the Khyber Pass in between Pakistan and Afghanistan. It was the major trade route for maybe 10,000 years. This temple ruined is the Svota temple, because in ancient Sanskrit wisdom, which was developed not originally in India, but by Zarathustra, he was from where we see Uzbekistan today. He was from Samarkand, but when he was later in his life married, he married the daughter of the king whose palace was in Kabul. And so Zarathustra wrote his Gathas in Kabul in 1925 BC, about the same time that Abraham found the promised land and was able to secure a taproot there by buying the cave of Machpelah as a burial place, not only for him and for Sarah, but for Isaac and Rebekah and so on, and it's still there today in Hebron. Their tombs are still there, but honored. The tomb of Lazarus is not honored. The tomb of Mary Magdalene is not honored. The tomb of St. John is not honored. The tomb of Mary, the mother, is over-honored through a church decision in the 1100s to have a new way to back up the Crusades. The one place that you can find a really good chapter on this vota is by Kapila Shastri, Sri Aurobindo, Lights on the Teaching, the last 30 or so pages, Svota and the Spoken Word. Svota is the primordial sound, but when it's combed, the Sanskrit word for speech is vak, V-A-C. And the way that you comb speech out of sound is that you arrange it so that it is language that has an energy cadence, so that all of the early written language are written in poetic, not rhetoric. Rhetoric is a later commentarial quality that comes out when there has been interrupted lineages of teaching, where one cannot hear not only truth, but truthfully hear truth through truthfulness, which is a visioning that goes on in a presence. Here's how the 13th Hermetica, and it's important that the Rebirth treatise has received a special study, Corpus Hermeticum 13, an early Christian literature, published in Leiden, Holland, 1979. But this is the way in which this Rebirth treatise expresses towards the end. Hermes is speaking to his philosophic son, Tot, and Tot says, "Father, I would now be taught that hymn of praise, which, as you have told us, Poimandres predicted that you would hear the powers sing when you had ascended to the eighth sphere of heaven. My son, you do well to seek that, for you are purified now that you have put away from you the earthly tabernacle. Poimandres, the mind of the sovereignty, told me no more that stands written in the book, for he knew that I should be able of myself to apprehend all things and to hear what I would and to see all, and he left it to me." There comes a threshold where in the Hermetica, one no further speaks. It's called the Hermetic silence. In that silence, the cascade of meaning occurs without a punctuation, without a break. It's like a special kind of cascade of wisdom. In 1976, after I had been back from being a professor in Canada for a number of years, I found that there was a dearth of understanding of just fundamentals about the Vajrayana. And so I brought from Toronto Karma Tinley Rinpoche to deliver a series of 10-day seminars conjointly. One was on the Tibetan language, which was never a peasant language. It was made to talk high Dharma. Another was to be able to have people understand what a lineage was. And so he chose at that time to deliver the Karmapa lineage. And with that was turned into a book, the history of the Karmapas. At that time, the 16th Karmapa, the Gyalwa Karmapa, was still alive. Now his reincarnation, the 17th Karmapa, is already a mature young man and taking up the Karmapa lineage. But Karma Tinley said, there are the famous sects in the Vajrayana, like the Galugpa of the Dalai Lama, the Karmapas. But there is a special sect that frequently has women carrying the lineage. And that's a Sakya lineage. He said the other lineages are reincarnations, like lighting a candle from the previous candle. But that the feminine Sakya lineage, he said, is like a waterfall. You don't need a present contact to have a causality that this is continuing. It's continuity itself. And so the feminine always has that eternal quality of wisdom. And this is the this is the 21st ode to Solomon. I lifted up my arms on high on account of the compassion of the Lord, because he cast off my bonds from me, and my helper lifted me up according to his compassion and his salvation. And I put off darkness and put on light. And even I myself acquired members. In them there was not sickness or affliction or suffering. And abundantly helpful to me was the thought of the Lord and his everlasting fellowship. And I was lifted up in the light, and I passed before him, and I was constantly near him, while praising and confessing him. He caused my heart to overflow, and it was found in my mouth, and it sprang forth into my lips. Then upon my face increased the exaltation of the Lord and his praise. Hallelujah. It is the incredible realization that has been dawning, that there is a tremendous linking of the Odes of Solomon and the Gospel of St. John and the Apocalypse of St. John. The way in which this can be expressed by James Charlesworth is that the most convincing argument is that they obviously were in the same community, that the community has a quality of language, a poetic insight that has the frequency of the breath of eternity in the very way in which time cadences are recognized. They're not cognized, they're recognized, which takes it out of the brain into vision by opening the mind. And if the mind is opened by vision, it can refine by art, and it can be kaleidoscopic by history, and achieve the ability to have a true analytic of the cosmos. And that by understanding that, then, one is able to move into a completely new quality. Matthew writes that the woman with the alabaster jar came and anointed Jesus on the head. And the Gospel of John says not only on the head, but on his feet. And then dried his feet with her hair. This is William Blake's etching of that event. If you read further into John, Jesus then stripped down to just his loincloth and went about washing the feet of his disciples, with only Peter demurring, saying, you're not going to wash my feet. You're too important. Jesus said, if your feet are not washed, you cannot go on the way. Oh, well, please then, wash my feet. That was Peter. Next week, we'll talk about how Matthew understood Peter very well. They were brothers-in-law. More next week.